Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Greetings and welcome to a new episode of New Books Network. Today is April 22, 2024. My name is Joaquin Rivaya Martinez, and I am an associate professor of history at Texas State University. I will be the host of this interview. Today, we will be chatting with historian Juliet Bierzema on her book, The History of a Periphery, Spanish Colonial Cartography from Colombia's Pacific Lowlands, which was published by the University of Texas Press in 2023. Good morning from Texas, and welcome to New Books Network, Dr. Bierzema.
Thank you so much, Joaquin, for having me. It's a real treat.
I guess I'm pronouncing your name in different ways every time I bring it up.
That's okay.
Since we are all friends, I'll be calling you Juliet, though, for the remainder of the interview.
That sounds great.
Thank you for being with us, Juliet.
Again, it's my pleasure, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share the book with your audience.
All right. So, Juliet Bierzema is an interdisciplinary humanities scholar. She holds a PhD in art history and archaeology from the University of Maryland and an MA in art history and archaeology from the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University. She teaches the art history of pre-Hispanic and colonial Latin America at the University of Texas in San Antonio, an R1 Hispanic-serving institution. She has published extensively on the art and architecture of the Moche of Peru and on manuscripts, maps, of 18th century coastal Colombia. Her work includes the books Architectural Vessels of the Moche, Ceramic Diagrams of Sacred Space in Ancient Peru, published by the University of Texas Press in 2015, and the book that she will be discussing with us today, The History of a Periphery, Spanish Colonial Cartography from Colombia's Pacific Lowlands, from the same publisher, University of Texas Press, which was available in print last year. Before she became an academic, she had brief stints in radio broadcasting, travel writing, and incentive travel planning. Her scholarly contributions enrich our understanding of the hemispheric Americas, indigenous knowledge and practices, the African diaspora, and critical issues in the field of art history, such as materiality, for instance. She approaches art history and visual culture through a transdisciplinary lens, drawing from history, archaeology, anthropology, ethnomusicology, architecture, geography, cartography, and environmental as well as technical studies. Her scholarship breaks new ground and advances our understanding of ancient Indian art and architecture, prehistoric acoustic artifacts, manuscript maps from Pacific frontiers in the Spanish Americas, emergent Black mining communities in Colombia's Pacific lowlands, and 18th century works on paper. So as you can see, she's been doing all kinds of work. So, Juliet, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you become an art historian, and were there any influential mentors or other figures in your early career?
Gosh, that's a good question. Yeah, thank you for that nice introduction. The path was not linear to academia or to art history. I grew up in California, and after college in Northern California, I ended up traveling around Europe and living in Barcelona for 4 years, hoping to work with the Barcelona Olympics in 1992. I ended up working illegally for a couple of years for the Generalitat de Catalunya on a conference that dealt with what is today called astrobiology, but back then it was called exobiology. And in that capacity, I ended up spending a week with scientists from NASA and the SETI Institute, who had such a great time in Barcelona, they said, you got to come back to the States and, you know, we'll do the same thing over there. So I ended up working at NASA Ames in the Bay Area for about 5 years. And I think at that time, being around that community of scholars was what pushed me into looking into academia. But also at that time, I had this crazy idea of becoming a travel writer. And that did not go so well. So at 33, I decided to go back to school to study art history. And the first decade, as you talked about, was spent working in South America, studying the Moche culture of Peru. And then about 10 years ago, wanting to shift to something completely different, I decided to focus on the visual culture of of 18th century Colombia, and happened upon a really spectacular map that depicts an area in Colombia's Pacific lowlands. At the time, I knew nothing about Colombia's Pacific lowlands or really anything about manuscript maps at that moment in time. But this map, the Dagua River map, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, is the map that launched 1,000 ships, so to speak, and led to my writing this book.
Where does your interest in colonial Latin America and specifically in today's Colombia come from?
Well, probably to my grandparents in the 60s and even in the 70s when this was not legal, collected pre-colonial antiquities, in large part because my aunt had married a Colombian and lived in Bogota for 10 years. This is in the 60s. So I think growing up and spending summers with her in Berkeley, California, where she always spoke to my cousins who are half Colombian in Spanish, I was determined to learn Spanish and be able to understand them. And then, you know, I also became really curious about what else went on in Colombia. So I think that's where the interest in Colombia came from. And I think the 18th century part was a desire to work with texts, because in the work I did with the Moche, who are a very advanced civilization, but a civilization that did not have written texts, I was kind of thinking, oh, it would be nice to have a little more written information to go to work from. So that's kind of how I ended up in the late Spanish colonial period in Colombia.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come up with the idea for this book, and what was your main goal in writing it?
I think the original idea was about micro histories, and could we find them in manuscript maps from a remote part of Spain's vast empire? And if we could find micro histories, you know, from these maps, what would they tell us? So the book ends up exploring a handful of manuscript maps that were made in Colombia in the 18th century. And each map depicts a different remote area of Colombia's Pacific coast. And the idea that's captured in these maps, you know, which depict areas that were and still are densely tropical and hospitable and very jungly. So you've got that on one side. And yet this area, the Pacific lowlands, despite being remote and very inaccessible to Europeans and to outsiders, it was an area of rich placer or gold mining, and it still is today. So while the Pacific lowlands were not really that well connected to the rest of the country, and certainly not to the centers of power in New Granada, the gold that was extracted and mined from this region was critical to the country's economy, and it served as New Granada's sole export until 1780. So most of the maps in the book come from the Archivo General de la Nación in Bogotá. The documents come from different archives in Cali and Popayan, places like that. But the AGN, just, you know, for any of your listeners out there who are interested, it has a vast collection of maps, something they call a mapoteca. They've also got, you know, a trove of Spanish colonial archival documents. And many of both the maps and the archival documents have been digitized. However, relatively few of these maps have been published, and even fewer have been studied in any depth. Though one idea in this, well, behind the book, I should say, is that as I looked into the Pacific lowlands, I realized that the areas that along the Pacific coast don't appear in any detail on the printed maps of the period. So these manuscript maps from Ptolemy's Pacific Islands become really important because they help to fill in gaps in our geographical knowledge. And these gaps, you know, are gaps left by printed maps. So as I was carrying out our couple of research in Bogota, I realized that the maps were not meant to be considered in isolation. And so you can't just pick up a map and get what's going on. At one time, they had all formed part of a larger case file. And sometimes these case files contained hundreds of folios or pages. And these documents in these case files would offer up names of people, of places, and of events that were related somehow to the map. And so from all these documents, and then working from the map, these local stories about very specific places came into view. And so my idea, kind of my hope, was that I could use these maps and their associated documents as a window to another world, much the same way that English art historian Kenneth Clark had done with European paintings in the 20th century. So I got to confess that it was his book, Civilization, that pushed me to pursue art history in the first place many years ago. But yeah, that's kind of the general idea behind the book.
All right. So since this interview will be available to a potentially very diverse non-specialist audience, maybe I'll ask you a very seemingly preposterous question. What are manuscript maps?
No, I mean, I think it's a good question. It's something that I actually grappled with in one of the chapters in the book. I mean, how do you differentiate them from printed maps? So, and it's important to differentiate them because they serve different audiences. They have different processes of creation. So a manuscript map ends up being a handmade map. You could still call it a manuscript. You could call it a handmade map. You could call it a manuscript map. Printed maps, you know, obviously are printed and they involve many hands and were often mass produced and widely distributed. Manuscript maps, however, existed as a single document with a very limited audience. And, you know, many are large, quite beautiful. Some are polychrome, so several colors. And so the manuscript maps become works of art in their own right. You know, when you have a printed map, you're usually dealing with professional engravers, you know, who might be working from a sketch. And so the engravers are interpreting areas that they don't understand very well. That is not what's happening with manuscript maps. You know, these are created by amateur map makers, many of whom remain unnamed, but they're usually people who know this area on the ground very, very intimately. And so the maps, you know, reflect that kind of local knowledge of geography. But it's worth noting that manuscript maps tend to not be to scale. So the geography can be a little bit wonky. And they're not even remotely accurate representations of geography. And they don't really try to be. Instead, they are trying to, you know, kind of argue a point. But I think for us as historians, the existence of a manuscript map serves as kind of a red flag that alerts us that there was a situation in that area at that time. And so some of these maps were, you know, end up being created to make it visibly clear that roads were needed or infrastructure was needed, that defense was needed. Other maps that were created, manuscript maps, were trying to show and argue that there was an interoceanic route in Colombia that would unite the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Other maps, manuscript maps, highlighted the existence of indigenous groups that, you know, in the 1740s, the Spanish really had no knowledge about. So these manuscript maps, you know, handmade amateur map makers, but they're making areas of New Granada visible. And these are places that Spanish authorities would, you know, really never make it to on their own. And so, you know, they're having to make decisions about places that they know nothing about.
So, Juliet, before getting into the nuances of your book, can you briefly describe to our listeners the region where these maps were made, the what you call the Greater Chocó in the Pacific lowlands of Colombia? What is it? What was it like in the 18th century? What was the landscape like?
Yeah, and I think the maps help to tell this story because you've got Spanish colonial documents to talk about the Greater Chocó. What they usually talk about is the scarcity and how difficult it is to get into areas of the Greater Chocó, because one of the things, you know, that is happening or that is a permanent fixture of Colombia are three mountain ranges. And you've got three cordilleras that run vertically, dividing up the country. Each of these, you know, at their height is 15,000 feet. So people are constantly having to negotiate either around the cordillera or up and over the cordillera. They're having to use rivers largely to traverse the geography. And so you, in the greater Chocó, what you have are this kind of interesting situation where you've got important resources, because really the only export for New Granada is gold. And that's a lot, most of that is coming out of the Chocó in the 18th century. But the people who are willing to go and live in the Chocó are, you know, kind of enterprising adventurers who are hoping to make it rich out there. There's little, or I should say less, Spanish administrated supervision in these areas. Mm-hmm. So it operates a little bit like a Wild West. But then you've also got sort of this demographic element of you have indigenous people, certainly in the Darién and around the Gulf of Urabá. But in other areas, as you move, you know, down the Pacific coast, you have fewer indigenous surviving groups. And so the Spanish forcefully relocate many enslaved Africans to mine for gold in these riparian regions in the Pacific lowland. So demographically, the Chocó is really, really diverse from an area, say, you know, New Spain, where things are more tightly controlled. There's a larger indigenous population, and there's maybe less of an African presence. But again, it is very, you get the sense that, it just feels very Wild West, but sort of in a jungly tropical environment, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. So the book, I think the book is very well edited. So congratulations to the publisher. It consists of an introduction, six chapters, four of which deal with or analyze particular maps of the area, a conclusions section, and two appendices, one including transcriptions of the map's legends, and another one consisting of a technical study of one of the maps. It is a meticulously annotated work, and it includes abundant color and black and white images, as well as a useful glossary of Spanish terms and a very thorough index. So congratulations on this terrific book. What was the process of researching and writing a book like this? Tell us a little bit about your sources and your travels.
Yeah, and I probably, you know, should probably start by saying, as you know, it takes a community, right? I mean, so there are the publishers. There was an indexer, you know, who did a terrific job. There are, talking more about the research, you have all the archivists who, I mean, I wouldn't have found most of these sources had it not been for the archivists at the Archivo General de la Nación, who really opened up their desks and their institutional knowledge and shared it with me. So in terms of the process, you know, it started, as I had alluded to, with this manuscript map of the Dagua River region, which, oddly enough, is not in Colombia. It is the only map, I think, in the book that is in a U.S. repository. So that's held in the Library of Congress. And though I was able to study that map first, we're not clear exactly how it left Colombia or exactly when, but it did. And it was acquired by the Library of Congress in 2000, I believe. But the process started with that. And I think in looking into that map, I realized, okay, like there are stories here to extract from these maps. It seems like these maps are allowing us to reconstruct histories from places, you know, that don't appear in the history books. And these places are ephemeral, so they might exist for a decade or two, and then they end up just disappearing. So I think the idea was to identify maps to serve as the focal point of the book. And I think initially, my idea was really to make it, I don't want to say a coffee table book, but I wanted to have lots and lots of maps that hadn't been published before to sort of highlight, you know, there are all these amazing, beautiful maps that we don't know much about. And, you know, here they are sort of for your delectation. But I think as I began to work in the Colombian archives, so in Bogota and Popayan and in Cali, I realized that each of these maps at one point, you know, had been part of this larger case file. I mentioned this earlier. But, and you could completely choose to disregard the case file. But if you do, then you miss all of these backstories and names of actors and sort of local events that are pushing society, or, you know, that are creating tensions. And so as I started to realize, okay, these case files, you know, kind of hold the secret to these maps. And without the case files, you can't, and the documents, and then you really can't begin to understand the maps. I decided to just focus on four maps. Mm-hmm. And those I chose in part because of their visual interest, but I also chose them for the wealth of documentary information that was available in the case file. So, so it became a very historical project. I think the initial idea was to feel a little bit more art historical, but there's just so much history that each of these maps tell that it felt important to illuminate those stories.
In chapter one, Juliet, you emphasize the distinctiveness of Nueva Granada among the Spanish-American viceroyalties. What made Nueva Granada so unique?
Yeah, this, I think, was surprising to me. Again, you know, coming to the Spanish colonial period from the pre-Hispanic period and really not being that familiar with any of the viceroyalties at the beginning, New Granada stands out for one reason, because of its geography and topography, as I've talked about. This, you know, series of mountain ranges and all the rivers made it really, really difficult and time-consuming to get around. So there's that element. There's the demographic element, where, as I mentioned before, there is certainly in the peripheries, and I think this is also true of the centers, you know, there is less of an indigenous presence and more of an enslaved African presence, but also what you get this group of people called gente de libre de color, right? And so you've got free people of color, which is basically a group that speaks of ethnic, you know, of mixing, of miscegenation over, you know, at least, well, who knows, you know, decades, centuries, ultimately. So demographically, it's really, really different. I think another thing that I didn't really think about in terms of New Granada is that as a viceroyalty, it's late. It's really late to the party. So you've got four viceroyalties in the Spanish Americas. You've got New Spain, you know, which was established in 1535. You have Peru, which is established in 1542. You have Rio de la Plata, also kind of late to the party and established in 1776. New Granada isn't established until 717. And then there are some issues with that. It's sort of demoted in 1723. It's reinstated in 1739. And this to me is interesting because it's not that we didn't know about it. It was explored early. So you got Vasco Núñez de Balboa exploring the Atrato River that we talk about in the book in 1512. And this is a year before, you know, he ends up allegedly being the first Spaniard to see the Pacific Ocean. But all of these factors that make it different as a viceroyalty, you know, topography, geography, demography, all of those things, Spanish oversight, you know, because of all of these factors, make it something that really it's a very difficult region to govern and because it's so spread out. And so, you know, it ends up being different that way, just to kind of give listeners a sense of how vast not only the country was, but like how long it took just to even get from Spain. You have the Spanish botanist Jose Celestino Mutis, who ends up heading up the Royal Botanical Expedition in New Granada. He leaves Madrid to take on this job at the end of June in 1760. He doesn't even get to Cartagena until the end of October. So it takes him 4 months just to get to the Caribbean part of Colombia or New Granada. It takes him another 2 months to get from Cartagena to the capital of Santa Fe de Bogotá. He doesn't go to the Pacific Lowlands, but if he had gone, that would have taken another month or two of travel, you know, over river, on foot to get there. So New Granada economically is, you know, different because it's driven by this gold economy, but it's also just impractical to transport anything that's perishable or of little value because transport was so expensive and so time consuming. And so, you know, this kind of will take us back to the maps. This challenging topography meant that very few cartographers or engineers would even venture to the Pacific Lowlands during the Spanish colonial period. Hence, you know, part of the reason why they don't show up on printed maps of the period.
In chapter two, you discuss the cartographic history of Nueva Granada since the early 17th century, and you emphasize that much of the Pacific lowlands remain, cartographically speaking, as you say, terra incognita, as late as the 18th century. Now, you have chosen four really interesting maps for the central chapters here. In chapter three, you discuss a map of the Atrato River and pueblos of Cuna Indians, produced around 1759. In chapter four, you analyze the 1783 map of the Chocó, Panama, and Cupica, and its associated case file. And those are very interesting maps and very, very interesting chapters. But I think we're going to gloss over those, at least for the time being, and move straight to chapter five, where you discuss the beautiful 1764 map of the Dagua River region. And I find this map particularly captivating and rich. What does this map tell us about the history of Africans in the region?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about that. But just out of curiosity, what is it for you that is so spectacular about this map? Is it the color or the...
It's you don't typically find, or at least in, I have some familiarity with maps of this time period, but for the what is now the U.S.-Mexico area, borderlands, and you don't have that type of colorful map made for this region. So you have a whole range of very different maps, some of them with a lot of the geographic details, some of them with legends that are very rich in terms of historical information. But there is nothing comparable to that map in terms of its beauty. You know, aesthetically it's very appealing, that map.
It is very stunning. I actually ended up, when I was working on it, I didn't blow it up. I just had a life-size print made. It's a big map. It's 8 sheets of paper adhered together. So it's the size of, you know, a writing surface, a desk surface, let's say. But I had it blown up kind of and hanging on my wall for a while. Because it's like a painting. It just is really quite spectacular. But yeah, I mean, you bring up this issue of legend. And I think what this map has, in addition to being like a stunning painting that is also a map, is this really detailed legend. And because we have this really detailed legend, we are able to get into some of the history of Africans in the area. Mm-hmm. So one of the places that that the map highlights that is in essentially the center of the map, there are two places. One is a place called Las Juntas, which was kind of a node. There are two rivers, the Dagua and the Pipita, that meet. Las Juntas is there. And so people coming into the area, you know, are kind of traveling through Las Juntas. And that continues on through the 19th century. The only other site really on the map, and this is, you know, this map is covering probably 1,000 kilometers of space guided by the Dagua River. The only other place that looks inhabited on this map is the site of Sombra Rio. And the map does, the legend doesn't, it names Sombra Rio. The map makes it look like it is the most populated place in the region, but you don't get that much more information from the map itself, except for you learn from the map that people, inhabitants of Sombra Rio, end up really driving the trade and transport in the region using canoes along the Dagua. So you get a sense from the map that Sombra Rio is its own kind of, I guess, commercial transport hub. Uh-huh. And that the people who live there, you don't necessarily know who they are from the map itself, but the inhabitants are not only controlling the canoe travel from Cali down the Dagua River into the port of Buenaventura, but they're also, you know, controlling and sort of in charge of all of the overland transport that goes into all the other regions on area, like nearby areas of the Pacific lowlands. So Somerville, you know, is basically put on the map through the Dagua River map. If you go to archives, you'll be very hard pressed to find anything. But in Cali in 1739, there is discussion of Somerville. And the way it's discussed is it is home to some 200 Africans who controlled overland and river transport. It mentions that in these documents as well. And the documents tell us that for decades, the inhabitants of Somerville, who included free blacks, runaway enslaved people, outlaws, you know, European as well as mestizo, you've got just like this mix of people living outside of the Spanish colonial society on what is essentially a little island along the Dagua River. The Spaniards described Somerville as a hedonistic place where residents did not participate in mass. They drank to excess. They committed robberies and attacks, and they lived scandalously. But, you know, so it sounds like a crazy place, but it, according to the documents, seems to survive at least until 1780. They're still talking about it in the same way. So it's in existence for at least 40 years. There's no evidence that Spaniards tried to destroy it. And I think in part, probably in large part, was because they completely depended on the inhabitants of Somerville, who are largely African, and their descendants, because they were the ones who knew how to navigate the very fast and dangerous Dagua River. They were vital to trade and transport in the region. This continues into the 19th century. You know, the role of Africans and their descendants along the Dagua. And though Somerville seems to have existed uninterrupted and sort of undisturbed for a good 40 years and maybe even longer. And so you've got, you know, people, because, again, there's limited control in this area by Spaniards, you have Africans who were brought there to mine initially, but because there's not as much oversight as you might get in other areas, they have days off. They, you know, charge people to, you know, for river transport. They might mine gold on their own, and they get to keep a percentage of that. And so it seems as though Africans in this region are able to, enslaved Africans are able to, within a reasonable, who's to say, you know, it's not reasonable, not it's reasonable, but maybe within 10 years or less, are able to purchase their freedom and that of their families. And so what you have are free communities living in this area. And those are, well, their descendants, some of their descendants are still in this region today. This area today, the Pacific Longlands, is still largely inhabited by people of African descent. Does that kind of...
Yep. It does. So in chapter 6, you analyze the 1770 map of the Yurumangi Indians. And there are some fascinating stories about this map involving Francisca's anthropologists as others, right?
Yes. Actually, can we just return to the Dagua map real quick? Just sure. To insert one little footnote about the pigments on the map?
Of course.
Okay, so because it is the only one, you know, that's located outside of Colombia, it ends up being at the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress, in addition to all its, you know, maps and manuscripts and all the amazing books that it also has a state-of-the-art testing facility and research, you know, like research and testing facility. And so with the preservation research and testing team or division, I was able to test the pigments of the maps, the papers. But the part that I'll just talk about here is that going into this testing, I sort of assumed or suspected that the colorants on the map would be organic, because this is a real remote area. And I just figured maybe mineral pigments wouldn't get to this region. But it turns out the three primary colors on the map, the red, the green, and the blue, are all minerally derived. Mm-hmm. So the blues are coming from azurite. The green is verdigris. The red is vermilion or cinnabar. And this is interesting because both azurite and verdigris are, you know, are found in association with copper deposits, which is being mined in this area. Uh-huh. And then you also have mercury, which is not being mined necessarily along the Dogwood, but in neighboring regions. And that, you know, cinnabar is found in conjunction with mercury. So you're getting this red vermilion pigment from that. So it's a map that's kind of about mining areas and about mine regions, but it's also created from minerally based pigments, which was kind of a fun surprise. And my suspicion is that they're probably, you know, locally derived rather than being imported. But yes, okay, back to your very good question about the map of the Yurimangi Indians. So I think this chapter, if you are someone who's approaching the book and you're only going to read one chapter, I would recommend this chapter. It has a little bit of something for everybody. The map that's the focus of this chapter presented a great mystery to me for many years. I found the map first, and so was working from it, but I could not find the case file that went with it. Right. But I suspected that it had to have a case file and that it would be a large case file, likely related to a big initiative or undertaking, because the size and the scale of the map itself, you know, was huge. This map must have taken a fair amount of time to assemble. The Dogo map was made of 8 sheets adhered together. This is made of 12. So this is the largest manuscript map that I've studied to date. So I did eventually find the case file, and it turned out it was housed in the same institution as the map. So both are in the Archivo General de la Nación in Bogotá. But in the 70s, there was a big initiative to separate the maps from the case files so that they could care for the maps separately. And this works out great in the cases where there still is a reference, like a cross-reference that tells you this map belongs to this case file and this case file belongs to this map. But for some reason, in the case of this Yurimangi map, the information has been lost. So the case file itself, just getting to your question about Franciscans, it tells a really interesting 18th century story about the discovery of an independent and as yet unknown, at least by the Spanish, indigenous group who had lived between the Naya and the Yurimangi rivers. So this is an area south of Buenaventura along the Pacific. The enterprising gold mining Spaniard who finds them, who discovers them, I should say. His name is Buenaventura de Otorola. His initial idea was, oh, great, you know, now I have a local labor force to help me mine. So he petitions, you know, to use their labor to mine for gold from the stream beds. But he also wants to construct a road that will connect his home in Popayan to this gold mining frontier where he was mining. So Otorola ends up investing a lot of time and a lot of money in this project, but his efforts are thwarted pretty much at every turn by the colonial authorities. And soon he is reported by his estranged wife as dead or missing in Peru. So we don't know what happens to this guy. At least I never found out. And so at this point, you have another influential colonist, a guy by the name of Pedro Agustin de Valencia, who would go on to found the Royal Mint in Popayan. So very, very wealthy, very, very powerful. He becomes interested in this area because he also has mines in the area. And so he also wants to build a road. And so where do the Franciscans come in? To justify the road, they kind of decide that they need to go in and colonize and Christianize this group of Indians. And so the people, you know, who they want to take on this task or the Franciscans in Cali. And so the Franciscans find their way there. There's a lot of missteps, you know, friars drown in rivers and, you know, people aren't able to make it. But eventually they get there and they start the process of the attempted colonization of these very independent Indians who they call the Yurimangi, or I guess who we call the Yurimangi. And so their appearance on the scene is both really terrible and really unfortunate, but also a little bit fortuitous because, well, the unfortunate part is they end up going to colonize and Christianize, but they end up infecting most of the Irumangi Indians with smallpox and killing them. But before that happens, a detailed ethnographic study is made of the Irumangi. So we know a lot about what they look like, what they ate, how they cultivated crops, that they ate tobacco rather than smoking it, things like that. But we also, from the Franciscans, have a 200-word language dictionary. So while today it doesn't seem like there's, you know, we don't have any information on Irumangi, at the very least, because of this initiative, we have some vestiges of the Irumangi that remain. And they're, you know, kind of preserved through this case file in the NAF and the Archivo de Bogota, the Archivo General in Bogota. But I'll just also interject like one other really interesting story that emerges from this map, which is a 20th century story. So in the 40s, you have a group of, I think largely Colombian, but international, some French, I think too, geographers, geologists, and linguists who find the case file. So they're able to find the same case file that eluded me for a long time. And the case file is called Misioneros de Irumangi. They get really excited about it. They set off into the Pacific lowlands to try to find this lost indigenous group. And so decades later, one of the participants, Ernesto Gull, reflects and really laments that the expedition did not find a single Irumangi. But they also did not know about the map. So had they had access to the map, you know, or known of its existence, they might have been able to at least find the roads or the house foundations for this group, which are very clearly articulated on the map itself. So, yeah, lots of fun stories to come out of this very large map.
So I have to agree with you that historians overlook maps too often, right? I have done some, I would say, fruitful research on 18th and early 19th century maps of northern New Spain. And it's kind of strange that maybe others haven't looked at them from the same perspective as I did. But anyway, so I would like to ask you a question that you address at the end of the book. What can manuscript maps contribute to the study of colonial Latin America?
Oh, well, you've done a lot of work with maps, and you've done really detailed work about locating places in space using many maps and then transferring all that information to a single map, which I think that's a huge project in and of itself. So, you know, I don't need to tell you, but yeah, I mean, what can we get from the study of these maps? I think in reflecting about this in the conclusions, I was sort of looking at what we learn about maps, what we learn about map makers, about peripheries, what we might learn about also about landscape itself. So I think for one, we learn about the existence of areas that don't appear on printed maps. And, you know, and this is happening on these manuscript maps. I think Sombrerío that we talked about earlier is a great example of that. So these maps help to concretize these places and allow us to see where on the landscape these ephemeral sites were located. Because otherwise, you know, maybe they're mentioned, but we have no idea, you know, where they were in relation to other places. So I think through the maps and manuscript maps in particular, we get a more holistic sense of their place in, you know, sort of geographical place, but also social, you know, their social place in late Spanish colonial society. I think maps and documents allow us to resurrect stories about individuals. So we learn about Spanish colonists, but we also learn about indigenous actors and African actors who lived in peripheral areas of the Spanish Empire. We might not know about them otherwise. Yeah. I think the maps also help to expose the fact that in peripheries, Spanish administrative presence was minimal, and it was often ineffective. I think that is coming to the fore more and more in colonial Latin American studies, but I think maps also make that pretty clear. Mm-hmm. So through maps and documents, we learn about adaptation, we learn about environment, and we also learn about multicultural entanglements, you know, of French as well in this area, French, Spanish, indigenous, African, their descendants. And so, yeah, so that kind of tells us a little bit about, you know, generally speaking, in terms of maps and map making, I think these examples in the book support G.B. Harley's early contention that maps are subjective, right? We can't really take them at face value. They're making arguments and they are concealing at the same time that they reveal. And so when we look at these manuscript maps, we have to understand that they were created to shape perceptions and to influence decisions. They're not trying to depict the truth, you know, an accurate reflection of what really is going on. They want their version, you know, sort of exposed. And though they will exaggerate space, they will fib about geography, and they will present only the argument that the map maker or the map commissioner really wants to highlight. There are a few other things, like I said, I could mention in terms of what else we get. We get a lot from maps. So I think it's important. I alluded to this earlier. You know, they were not created to be self-evident. So to be responsible, we have to find and carefully read the documents that help to explain the maps, or we risk misinterpreting or missing something, you know, important that these maps have to offer us. I think the maps shed light on the role of local informants. So you've got indigenous actors, Africans who are informing the geography of these maps. Oftentimes they are guiding the map maker. They're probably providing safe passage for the map maker. Uh-huh. And they're probably also providing sustenance, you know, helping to find food and water in these remote areas that these Europeans are trying to map. I think we can also look to these maps to learn about peripheries. So namely that a periphery is relative to the center. These manuscript maps depict places on the Pacific or connected to it. And so you have those people living along the Pacific, you know, along this Pacific periphery. They may not have been in regular contact with those people in major administrative centers like Bogota, but they were in regular contact with other nodes along the Pacific. So, you know, a place like Cupica, which is, you know, discussed as a chapter in the book, it is a tiny little bay that, you know, tries to become a port. It's very far from its land neighbor, I think Bete, was about 8 days away. But you can get to Panama in 6 days. So obviously, you know, they're going to trade with Panama. They can get what they want from Panama, from Guayaquil, from Tumaco, much more easily than they can get things, you know, from the center of New Granada, obviously. Just see if there are any other things I should mention. I think, too, these maps show that these peripheries, places like the Pacific lowlands, were not backwaters, but were instead dynamic, multi-ethnic spaces, you know, of interaction where people are adapting, resisting, and making their homes. And, you know, I think they also highlight the great economic importance of this area by pointing us to the gold mining that's happening, you know, as well as to the rivers and routes that move gold out of the Pacific lowlands, you know, and into the global market. And I think, you know, lastly, these maps tell us a little story about the triumph of landscape. So you have, you know, Spaniards who are completely overwhelmed by this dense tropical area, for, you know, jungly area. For them, it's a hardship post. They don't want to spend much time there. When they do, they get sick. But at the same time, these same spaces, which were pretty much uninhabitable for Europeans, provided ample sustenance, places of refuge, and opportunity for native inhabitants, as well as Africans and their descendants, who, you know, as I mentioned earlier today, call this area home. So lots to get from manuscript math.
Thank you very much for your explanations, Judith. Can you tell us now a little bit about your ongoing project, which sounds fascinating?
A new project?
Yeah, the one that brought you to the Huntington, where you currently are.
Okay. It's very, very rough still. Yeah, so I think it's going back in time about a century. So this is looking at the late 17th century. And I was at the John Carter Brown Library looking at something that we call colloquially the Hack Atlas. And there isn't just one Hack Atlas. There are, I think, 12, 14 that exist in different repositories in the US, but also in Europe as well, in England. And so this is an atlas that has a separate map for like every coastal area from Acapulco down to Tierra del Fuego. And these are huge. They're beautiful. You know, a lot of them are illuminated. But what's interesting about this atlas, well, the set of atlases, is that it depicts areas that were, theoretically controlled by Spain at that time. But these Hack Atlases were created by an English chart maker named William Hack, hence the name Hack Atlas. And he gets the data, essentially, from a stolen Spanish map, de Otero, a book of charts. And the stolen map is acquired by English pirates in 1682, who were, kind of trawling, I guess you could say, and attacking Spanish ships along the coast of, along the Pacific coast. But they managed to get their hands on this Spanish book of charts. They take it back to England, have it copied for Charles II. And then, today the vestige of that are these remaining, dozen or so beautifully illuminated atlases. So what am I doing with these? These are good questions. I'm using them to kind of think about these places of interaction that aren't even on land, like these islands where navigators are going to get fresh water, to resupply, to careen their ships, to, find safe harbor. But again, because we've got, Spanish navigators are needing to do this too, but they're able to go, they can, pull into a Spanish port without problems. The pirates are really relegated to these islands if they're trying to stay under the radar. So these islands become these spaces of interaction between the French, the Dutch, the English, the Spanish. Sometimes they collaborate, sometimes they fight. It just, sort of depends on the circumstance. But it's very, very underdeveloped at this point. But I promise that whatever results from this will have spectacular maps at the very least.
I'm sure. It has been a pleasure to chat with you, Juliet. Thank you very much for sharing with the audience of New Books Network some of the nuances of your book.
Thank you so much for letting me share this with you. And thanks so much for spending time to read the book and think about it. And thank you for being willing to introduce it to your New Books Network audience. I appreciate it, Joaquin.
It's been a pleasure. So good luck with your project. And I look forward to interviewing you again soon, okay? No. When your new book is out.
Or maybe I can interview you in the meantime. Your many projects. Thank you so much.
All right. And to all of you, many thanks for listening to New Books Network. Kindest regards, and I'll say goodbye for the present.